From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just a few weeks ago when a spacecraft launched by NASA got close to a dwarf planet and sent home some remarkable images. I suspect you're thinking about Pluto, but this time I'm talking about Ceres, a dwarf planet in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Pluto seems to have stolen some of Ceres' thunder. If you missed it, there were a couple of photographs that have sparked debate over a mystery. On an otherwise flat stretch of landscape on Ceres, there rises what appears to be a pyramid-like structure. Photographed from directly above, that structure seems to glow. Aliens. Well, probably not, but what is that thing anyway? This is the joy and pain of science. It moves from the joy of discovery, the cool factor, the wow factor, to the pain of admitting, for now, I have no idea. University of Rochester astrophysics professor Adam Frank goes a step further. Writing for the NPR 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog that he co-founded, Frank says, quote, "Along with this great beauty comes something much harder to bear. What do you do about the answers that lie beyond your reach? I've spent much of this month working on two papers about the evolution of intelligence in the universe. The question my colleagues and I are addressing is, at the root, pretty simple. Have other species on other planets evolved intelligence? It's a well-formulated question, and it is a question that must have an answer. In my lifetime, however, I am probably never going to know that answer. I am ignorant. And it's killing me." And so I invited Adam Frank to come on the program today to talk about what we've learned recently about Ceres and Pluto and more, and what big mysteries he'd love to solve but probably never will. Let's talk about accepting our ignorance, painful as it may be, and it can be painful even for a scientist who accepts it. Right, Adam?
Yeah, it's part of the game, and I accept the fact that, this is the way it's going to be. But for certain questions, especially when you work really deeply with something, and it's that recognition that I just won't know, that I will go to the grave, and this question that I've spent so much time working on, I'm just not going to know it. And the fact that there is an answer, right? There's some questions that it's kind of harder to know what the answer looks like, but questions that really you know have an answer and that you're not going to get, that's frustrating.
A great man once said, "Dear God, what is that thing?" In regards to the glowing pyramids on Ceres, what do you think those things are?
Well, I'm going to put in a big plug for the Expanse series, which is coming up on Sci-Fi, best science fiction series ever, the books at least. And so, I was hoping that it was actually going to be an alien artifact that would then lead us to, interdimensional or interspace transportation network, but I'm going to bet it's ice. They're big blobs of ice, probably. But that moment, what's really cool is that moment of being like, I don't know. Like, look at those shiny spots on Ceres. What are they? That's a really cool moment in a lot of ways.
Yeah, more likely than not that it's ice, what else could it be?
Well, it's something. All right. So the fact that it's shiny means it's got to have something that has a high reflectivity. And, that's really kind of limits us to certain. We understand what's nice about science, right, is we understand which things reflect light well and which things don't. So like a big chunk of carbon, probably not. Carbon has, very low reflectivity. So, and whether or not you'd have like a patch of metal or something that large on the surface, that doesn't normally happen with metal. So, and especially this is the thing we know, once you get past the asteroid belt, there's a lot of ice. There's a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of ices, not just water, but CO2, methane. So I would expect actually that there would be a lot of frozen liquid out there at that those distances.
Is it fun not knowing? I mean, or is it frustrating in this case just because this is one that feels like it could be within our grasp, but we probably not going to get an answer?
What's interesting is I'm now old enough that there are missions that are being planned now that I will be fully retired. I will be out of the business by the time they launch. And then you look at, with the Pluto mission, that was 10 years from the launch to when it got there. So anything out at the, in the outer solar system, another mission to Ceres or missions to say there's the moons around Jupiter that we know have liquid oceans underneath icy surfaces. I will probably, I could well be gone or at least not working at that point. And so that part's that's a little sad. I'm kind of sad about that.
Talking to Adam Frank, an astrophysics professor at the University of Rochester, author of a couple of books that you should read. He writes for the New York Times on occasion, and he's the co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. And his piece on ignorance sparked this conversation. If you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, some people are desperately trying to get answers in their lifetime to the kinds of questions that you probably have on your list that won't be solved. For example, I just read a headline that a Russian billionaire is investing $100 million to try to find out if there is life in the universe. Is that interesting to you? Do you think that's more of a vanity project, or do you think, hey, if you want to put the money down, okay?
No, I think it's a great project. I mean, I think it's in many ways, it's the most important scientific question we have. Is there life? Has this happened anywhere else? And, you know, I've now been moving in my own research to looking at that problem in a bunch of different ways. We talked when I was here last time about its relationship to the Anthropocene and what we're going through. But that question of, right, does life exist anywhere else of even bacterial form, but then certainly when you get to intelligence, is so fascinating. And you know, the interesting thing about it, we've tried to do large-scale studies of this before, right? We've got radio telescopes, we can look. And every time NASA has tried to do this, some congressman stands up and says, we're not going to waste money on little green men, and the project has died, right? So we've never had a really concerted, long-term, a heavily invested effort to carry out a search like this. So I'm all for this. This is great that this guy's doing it.
The government wants to spend money that is perceived as good investment. And by the way, I saw you cheering the photonics investment in Rochester yesterday. You want to put in a quick comment on that? That was
this
a pretty
is
neat day.
Phenomenal. This is a great day for Rochester. I mean, photonics and big data, and they're kind of connected, you just can't hype them enough in some sense. They're not hype. These are technologies that already we're beginning to see them transform human society. And so for Rochester to be chosen for this, if this is done intelligently, if the investments are made well, the bets are made well, then this could utterly transform this community.
But when it comes to the kind of investment that you're talking about that always get maligned by some congressmen, you use the phrase little green men, and that's always the pejorative that gets tossed around.
Right.
Why are we still so backwards in thinking about intelligence that way, as if it could only be little green men that have nefarious purposes?
Right.
We have to get over that, I think.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. And it's funny, actually, that, you know, for a bunch of different reasons, we need to start thinking about this question of other species, other intelligent species, in a different way. The fact that it's always been laughable at this point in our evolution, we should stop this, because in many ways we should. I would argue that it's most likely that it's happened many, many, many times. The paper I'm working on right now sort of sets we're working to try and come up with a lower limit for the probability. Like, how low does the probability have to be for us to be completely alone, completely ever, you know, that's never happened before. And the number is so low, that turns out, that, you know, you don't have to work too hard for this to have happened many times. So we should see ourselves, instead of this idea of ridiculing it, we should be thinking, you know, intelligence probably pops up all over the place. And the things we're going through now, even with, you know, climate change, are probably pretty common.
We're going to talk more. I would want to ask you a little bit more about that, because I find that work to be a remarkable challenge to sort of set parameters on how you make this. I want to know more about what you're doing, but I'll grab our first phone call. And this is Barbara in Brighton. I'm with Adam Frank. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi there. I just wanted to be silly and say, first of all, it could very well be little green women.
It is 2015. We have to get over
planet
that.
Planet of the little green women.
There
I'm
you
all
are.
For it.
Absolutely.
Little green women. And secondly, you're in the perfect bound to be disappointed about, you know, probably not living to see some of your work come to fruition, because, of course, that was Susan B. Anthony's whole story. You know, she worked her entire life to get women the vote and died in 06, and they didn't get the vote till 1920. So you're in the perfect town.
That's good. That's good. There's a long tradition of disappointment, but of working for the right thing and then having to leave before you get to see it.
You know, that's why she said failure is impossible.
Yeah, exactly.
She knew that it was.
That's a great point. Thank you.
Barbara, great.
Well, have a good day.
Thank you, Barbara. That's a very good point. And that leads me, I was going to bring this up later, but Barbara redirected the conversation, as sometimes happens. So let me bring it up now. Barbara brings up the fact that you're working on something that you know has an answer. You're not likely to get in your lifetime. You might, not likely. And you could do what a lot of people do in that scenario, and they say, okay, well, then I'm going to work on sort of a finite time, you know, the kind of timeline that I will be able to get some sort of result, or I will do something that I will feel is not sort of fruitless within a lifetime. But you're not. you're working on this question of what is out there, if anything, just the same way Susan B. Anthony worked on knowing something was probably not happening in her lifetime, but it was worth working on anyway. Death doesn't bother you thinking about that?
No, in that way, yeah, no, death doesn't. I mean, you know, this is an interesting, right, the question of death and what happens after death. Like, there's one of these big questions that, you know, it's not even clear that it's amenable to science. But yeah, no, it doesn't bother me in that way because, you know, I'm going to do the work that I do and it's fun, right? I mean, all of this is fun. And actually, I do work on questions. I mean, it's important for people to understand how science works in the sense that even when I'm working on, you know, some of my papers are going to try and hit this on the biggest level. But then, you know, a lot of the papers I work on are just like tiny little pieces that contribute to the overall understanding. So, you know, those would seem utterly boring to anybody, but they're still very important pieces of, you know, it's a brick that you then put another brick on and another brick on. So I'm working in both domains. But in that sense, yeah, death, you know, on one level, we do this because it's interesting and it keeps us alive, right? I mean, in the sense of it makes the world beautiful and it generates passion and enthusiasm. And as long as I'm breathing, that's what I want.
You wrote about death about 6 months ago on the NPR 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. And you wrote the following, quote, even though none of us existed 1,000 years ago, you don't find many people worrying about their non-existence during the Dark Ages. Our not being in the past doesn't worry us. So why does our not being in the future freak us out so much? You want to expand on that thought?
Yeah, that's always been an interesting thing. So, you know, I actually, you know, unfortunately had, you know, death sort of come into my life very early. I had a brother who was killed in a car accident when I was 9. He was 15. And so, you know, that was, you know, without doubt the most important event in my life. So, you know, I've always sort of had death, you know, I've just, the idea that your check can be canceled or your contract can be canceled at any moment came into my life really early. And what was interesting was it didn't propel me into sort of, it made me very unafraid of death. Of just sort of, it's something that happens, right? And it's clearly something that's going to happen to me. And so rather than, I don't have a lot of panic or terror about it all. I mean, you know, as Woody Allen said, you know, I don't mind dying. I just don't want to be around when it happens. So I certainly, you know. But the idea itself, and so when I see people having that sort of real anxiety about death, it always occurs to me, like, why are you bothered by something, your non-existence in the future? Whereas, like, you don't think about 1932 and go, oh my God, I wasn't here in 1932. How can that be? I'm freaking out. So it's like, to me, they're totally symmetrical. So whatever's going to happen is going to happen. But the non-existence part, I've already experienced non-existence in some weird way.
And it was fine.
Yeah, it was fine. Yeah, not a big problem.
Well, here's what Paul Fidalgo writes in response. Paul's an atheist writer who works for the Center for Inquiry. And he wrote the following, quote, we experience time linearly in one single direction, so we'd have no reason to be concerned about not existing in the past. We are incapable of ever having perceived that which came before us, but we are able to perceive the present as it unfolds into the future, and we are aware that at some point, for each of us, that present will stop unfolding. We don't witness the past before our birth, so we have no reason or frame of reference for concern. We do witness ourselves in the present moment and are cognizant of the fact that we will or ought to exist in future moments. And we are also aware that there will come a time when that existence, that awareness, will stop forever. And that sucks. Paul Fidalgo.
See, I actually think that's, for me, that's a great misunderstanding about time because, you know, I don't exist in the future. I can imagine the future if I want. I can imagine the past if I want. But really, fundamentally, time only manifests itself in the present. So both my imagining of the future, to me, is absolutely equivalent to my imagining of the past. And so non-existence, also, we have to think about what we mean about non-existence. If truly what we're talking about is at the end of life, that's it. There's no existence whatsoever. Then you're not there to notice it's not happening, right? I mean, so my non-existence in the future would have the exact same cognitive or experiential or, you know, existential manifestations as my non-existing in the past because there's no me there to say, oh, wow, I'm not existing. This is terrible.
I don't disagree. And I don't think Paul would. I think what he's saying is the difference is he's now aware of existence versus non-existence, and he is totally in favor of existence, that there is something really exhilarating about being alive and knowing that you don't get that beyond a little blip on the interstellar timeline is a little disappointing.
Yeah, it's weird. I agree with that. But I mean, I understand that. That's certainly now, you know, when I look towards the future, when I imagine the future, I know there's a future without me. But in terms of what I was writing there was about sort of the dread you know, the dread that can come about from this. Yes. I totally agree. I would like more years. You know, I don't know if I'd want immortality because that would get kind of dumb.
There's no way.
Yeah, right.
I would not.
How much ice cream can you eat?
No way.
So, but certainly the idea that, like, oh, I'm terrified by the end of this, which motivates a lot of people. I mean, a lot of the religions, the fire and brimstone in a lot of religions comes from that fear of what will happen next. And so that's the part that I was really speaking to in that article.
Talking to Adam Frank, an astrophysics professor from the University of Rochester, an author, a contributor to the New York Times, and the co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. And you tweeted on this question recently, so I think this is related, but more recent. Here's what you tweeted a couple of weeks ago, actually last week. You wrote, quote, "I would argue that a lot of humanity's worst screw-ups come from our demand for certainty in the face of mortality. It just messes us up."
Yeah. And I think that's really, certainty in general is something that I combat against, which is funny because some people are like, well, you're a scientist, you know, you demand certainty. Well, that's not the way science works. Science works with degrees of uncertainty. And that it's that need to sort of pin the world down in the face of our not knowing. I think that's where so much of the stridency and the militancy and the horror that we inflict on each other comes from, that demand that, look, I need, even if it's, you know, even if it's wrong, I just need something that I can tell myself is absolutely true. When, you know, so much of our lives is in flux and is fluid. And if we became more comfortable with that, we wouldn't have the need to beat somebody else over the head with, you know, that, to make them agree with us so that we'd feel better about our, you know, our beliefs.
Is it about then just coming to terms with that non-existence from the Dark Ages or the Paleozoic, which I wasn't around to hang out for? Is that an effort worth undertaking? I don't know how you get there as a species.
I think, well, it's got to be individual, right? I mean, that is the work. Well, it's the stories we tell ourselves, too, the mythologies that we have, right? You know, so my first book had a lot about mythologies. And mythologies are the narratives, the stories that the culture, you know, that we you know, the kids get it from early on. The stories we tell our kids about what the world is, how, why it's that way, what their role in it is. And so, you know, if you have mythologies that are literal, you know, that say this is absolutely what happened, you know, this is the nature of the universe, and there's, you know, if you don't believe it, then you're going to hell, then I think that does a lot of damage, right? So, but you could have mythologies that taught people to sort of rejoice in the mystery, the openness, right? And religions have that too. All the religions have that component too, where, you know, they're able to embrace the uncertainty. And we'd be better off with that. We'd be wiser and more compassionate if we had that attitude.
So, in other words, if we just sort of bifurcate religion and atheism, as religion is always into certainty and atheism is open-minded, that does a disservice to a lot of the religious traditions that are okay.
Oh, absolutely.
That.
The people, you know, I have many good friends who are deeply religious, and their approach to their religion is this one of this great mystery that they're trying to unpack, not one of literal, this is the absolute way it is. And, you know, and again, that's where I think the wisdom, you know, the wisdom traditions in all the religions are, that's where they arise from.
Yeah, I think of my own experience as a 14-year-old, and I'm not going to deluge our listeners with my own religious background or my own spiritual journey, though I'm not ever afraid to say that I'm a happy and optimistic skeptic. But I went through this sort of phase at 14 where I wanted some big answers and went through classes with a Catholic priest who was just fantastic. And I remember saying, boy, there's so much of what you're having me read that just doesn't really line up. And he said, that's okay to doubt. And he said, I don't want you to ever think that you can't doubt. And I found that comforting.
Right.
That I wasn't told, well, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, that you're doubt. I mean, you know, how can you approach these big the biggest questions, the ones that probably I am not, that I would say, it's not even clear to me that there are answers for,
right?
Or what would you do, you know, the meaning of life. If I gave you the meaning of life, you'd be like, oh, that's great. And then 10 minutes later, you'd still have the same problems that you would have to deal with. I mean, there's some aspects of being human that just are open-ended. So having a way of approaching those that leaves them open but allows you to learn throughout your entire life. You know, many religions, many of the people I encounter who I respect the most who are religious have that really healthy sense of a dialogue with the world. Whether, you know, for them, it's a dialogue with God. I don't go there. But it's a dialogue. It's an ongoing discussion, not a set of rules, which if you violate, you know, you're going to get punished.
And this is where Constant Fire and so much of the work that you've done, I think, bridges a little bit of a gap. And I think there is a gap that has existed between atheist and people of traditional worldly religions today that misses the point that you can look up at the stars and feel intensely spiritual, even if you don't feel like you want to talk directly to a prophet or a god or whatever. But there is something that does sort of reach across boundaries with people who do count themselves among the major religions of the world, yeah?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, for me, that when in the book, I focused on two words. One was awe, the sense of awe, which Rudolf Otto, a scholar, liberal scholar from the turn of the last century, identified the experience of awe as being fundamentally the root of religious experience. And the funny thing to me is that Richard Dawkins will talk about awe. You know, the most strident skeptic will talk, or not skeptic, but atheist will talk about awe. But then they'll be like, well, that has nothing to do with religion. It's like, dude, that has been identified as the fundamental character of a religious experience. So awe is something that is fundamental to us. It's ancient. It's an ancient experience. And out of that can arise different directions. You may choose to join a religion, or you may choose to become a scientist, or you may choose to keep your skepticism open. But that standing before the openness of nature and the weight of its questions is spirituality. And then the other word is sacredness, sacrament, which is interesting because people think, oh, sacred, that word is absolutely about Catholicism. It goes back to Roman temple architecture. It's a place in the temple. It's the sacer. And that's where you did your, you had to do your religious, absolutions or whatever. And outside you could sell your Grateful Dead tapes, But so sacred really refers to an attitude, a place, a response to the world. So I think those are absolutely common to whether you believe in a deity or not. These are fundamentally human responses to the world.
Let me grab a question or comment from a listener. Stephen Brighton wants to talk about uncertainty with religion. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Good to listen to you too. Adam was talking about questioning and grappling, and Adam was talking about faith. And one of the Jewish religious figures speaking on the formation of Sabbath talked about how when the Jews lost their temple, they made a temple out of time and space versus physical space. But you reserved this worshipful time instead of space. And since Adam is a... works in time and space quite a bit, I thought I'd like to hear his reaction to that.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, right? And I think that's what's beautiful about that story is the idea that it's not a thing, right? That the spiritual practice, the communing, the having community with, for the Jews, their sense of deity, was not something that was a bunch of, was a building, right? It's more about your experience, right? And I think that we, in general, all of our religious practice would be better if we understood that it's not about things. It's not about, and it's not about a bunch of lists in a book. It's about this very much alive, ongoing experience that's the root of where our spirituality of one form or another should come from.
What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Adam has won you over. Thank you, Steve. Adam Frank, my guest, is the author. We've been talking about some of your books, so you didn't come here to plug a book. I came here to plug the book for you. You want to mention it? Go mention it.
Well, the first book was The Constant Fire, Beyond the Science Versus Religion Debate. And then my second book was called About Time, Cosmology and Culture at the Twilight of the Big Bang.
I think Constant Fire is generous toward, I would say generous is maybe the wrong word, but I think it is... it's not strident. It is understanding of human condition. I don't know if you're sometime soon on this program, we can talk about your feelings on, we had this brief talk about an article you're working on about climate change, about how it was almost inevitable anyway. And that doesn't mean that it's a good thing or that we should just sit back and with our feet up and say, well, it's too bad it's happening.
Yeah, no, it's just the idea that what's interesting to me, and this goes back to our question of, is there intelligent life anywhere else in the universe? So here is a question that has an answer, and I don't know what it is, but it definitely has an answer out there. What is the average lifetime of a intelligent technological species,
mm-hmm.
right? So, imagine that I go out and I look and I find 1,000 species that have gone through, and some of them could be gone. I could be doing archaeology, but let's imagine that, right? And I could put together their histories, right? And I could look to see, oh, well, from the time that they invented the steam engine or whatever, some version of that, to the time that they wiped themselves out or disappeared, how long was that? Was it 200 years? Was it 2,000 years? Was it 2 million years? And this question, right, must have an answer. I can, you know, what I just imagined doing must be real, that I can go out and, you know, that there are those species. So that means that average, that number exists. I could calculate it. And it's so important for us, right? How long, we're trying to build a sustainability, sustainable society now. And we have no idea if it's even possible, right? If that average number, if you went out and found the 1,000 species, you know, did the archaeology or talked to them, and that average number turns out to be 200 years, we're in big trouble, right? If that's the average, that means that in general, nobody gets more than 200 years, and we're about 200 years ourselves. If that number turns out to be 2 million years, yeah, right? Then we've got a chance of negotiating what we're going through and figuring out how to build a sustainable human society.
We're going to take a break. I'm going to come back, and I'm going to ask him, first of all, to guess what he thinks the answer to that is. And then I want to know, what is your list of the big questions? We're talking about ignorance. Adam's excellent piece recently on the NPR 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog on ignorance, a piece called Science and the Agony of Ignorance, sparked this conversation. And as he has said, there are some questions that are not really answerable by science. What is the meaning of life? Things like that. But a question that says, what exactly is that mountain on Pluto made of? It appears to be ice. What kind of ice? How cold exactly is it? Those are finite answerable questions that we just may simply never get an answer to. So what are the ones that are answerable that probably won't get answered and that's really eating Adam up? We get that after this break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections. The Rochester City School District has a new code of conduct policy. Our panel will talk about when it's okay and when it's not okay to suspend or expel a student and whether the new policy will work. Then second hour, saving the Chautauqua Institution. A group is trying to do that. We'll talk about the Chautauqua Institution and what Rochester landmark should also be saved. It's all Wednesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Freed Maxick CPAs, an audit, tax, and consulting firm working to meet the dynamic needs of local businesses. Services available in Rochester, freedmaxick.com.
Welcome back to Connections. Evan Dawson with Adam Frank this hour. You're seeing why Adam is what I list as my favorite radio guest here. I didn't mean to make Adam blush here, but I just love talking about...
My favorite radio host.
Oh, well. I love talking about the nature of what we know and what we don't know. Mm. And one of the themes for this program, ever since I was able to humbly take this chair that has been served so well for three decades now, is that we embrace I don't know. That we don't feel there's anything wrong with ever saying I don't know. That too much of talk radio, but too much of life in general, politics, public debate, policy, is filled with this false sense of certainty. And that we love saying I don't know because it opens the door to maybe eventually knowing and maybe not knowing. So for you, what's the start? Where is the top mystery that definitely has an answer? It's got to be the intelligent life
question.
Yeah,
that's my top.
Because that's what you're working on.
Yeah.
So that's at the top of the list. So if the question then is, if that's number one, we'll get to number two, three, and four in a second. But what do you think the answer is? A technological civilization, which we may be sitting in the middle of the only one that's ever existed in the universe, or we may be one of hundreds or thousands or dozens or five. What do you think the average lifespan is?
All right. Well, first, let me just answer. First of all, I think that the number of just in species, I think, is huge. I think this has happened many, many, many times.
You do think it's happened many times?
Yeah, and that comes from this paper I'm doing where, you know, I calculate the lower probability, you know, we were able to calculate, I think, we'll see what happens when it gets reviewed, but the minimum probability, right, yeah. that it can't be lower than this. And that number was so low, meaning that, it should be so easy to make it happen that in the overall in the universe that I think it must have happened trillions of times. So there's trillions of times this thing has happened. And
when you say this thing, we're going from singular, cellular, simple life to multicellular, possible intelligent, civilized life.
Yeah, civilizations like us. And then onward, I guess the question is, what does onward look like? Because that's an interesting question. Does everybody become machines? Does everybody download their consciousness into machines? And there's only a brief window of, you know, biological... So who knows? That's a whole other question. So I think that this has happened, you know, many, many times. And so then the average, you know, it's so hard for me because I could pull a number out. I hope it's millions, you know, hundreds of millions of years. That's what I hope. That's my, you know, but I just don't know.
So that's okay to say you don't know.
Yeah, it's because like, well, I've just done this work that sort of convinces me that it's happened, that, you know, in some sense, that up to this point, it has happened trillions of times. When I say up to this point, I mean this kind of civilization.
That we have on Earth.
That we have on Earth. But further than this, there's a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of questions that I just am at a loss for. I'd just be guessing, right? So I hope it's, and think about what that would mean. What would it mean for like human civilization to go on for hundreds of millions of years?
Fascinating question.
Right? We wouldn't even be human anymore, right? By that, you know, evolution works on scales of, you know, 10 generations you're already beginning to change. So hundreds of millions of years. But wow, that would be cool. That would be really interesting.
It would be very cool. And Bill in Brighton wants to jump in on that point. Go ahead, Bill.
Adam, Bill Ferguson, Garth Fagan, Dance.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Hey, man. If indeed there's ultimate, infinite number of possibilities, and the average is 200 or 200 million, what if we're better than average?
Well, that's the question, right? I mean, that's the question of whether or not, you know, so if it's a long, you know, if the average is very long, right, you know, 100 million years, then that's good for us because we're just starting, right? We've only had this kind of civilization for at most 100 years. So if that average is long, then that gives us a much better shot that we're going to, even if we screw up with some of the decisions we make, that there's enough flexibility that we'll be able to keep going. If it's short.
What do you mean if we screw up?
Well, because we got decisions we got to make, right?
I mean, nuclear annihilation.
Yeah, I'm even more with climate change, though, right?
Climate,
I mean, how
change,
do we,
yeah,
deal, what we have got a bunch of decisions to make about climate change, about where do we, what kind of energies are we going to start using in the future? How are we going to organize ourselves to keep, you know, the biodiversity rich? So, you know, and we don't, it's such a huge issue, we don't even know how to get started on it. So that's what I mean about sort of screwing up. Hopefully this, you know, hopefully there's a lot of options for doing it right rather than just one way of doing it right. So
I'm sure. Great talking to you. Great,
hey,
show.
Thank you very much. He's one of many who I'm getting comments on Twitter. Please have Adam on every month. I would. Adam is this peripatetic figure that is constantly traveling about our universe doing this kind of work. But if you missed his last visit in April, we talked about climate change as a possible great filter, and by that we mean something that would prevent a civilization from becoming really, really sort of technologically advanced, interstellar travel, etc. And I want you to just briefly address the point again that you made on that show, which is that you are concerned about climate change here, but no matter where intelligent life unfolds, and you now believe through the work you're doing that it has happened many, many, many times, that climate change is almost certainly something to grapple with on those places as well, because the one constant, I don't know if constant's the wrong word, is that they have to deal with atmosphere, and technological and energy output will impact an atmosphere no matter what the atmosphere is made of and no matter what the energy is made,
yeah,
of.
That's exactly it. There's the laws of thermodynamics, which tell us that if you know, you got a system, which is what a planet is, it's, you know, you got a planet that's absorbing solar energy, there's an atmosphere, the sun heats up the surface, and then the atmosphere starts circulating, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The laws of thermodynamics tell us that if you dump more energy into that system, it's going to change. And so those changes are predictable, right? We have a bunch of different planets that we've seen their behavior. We got Venus, which has got an atmosphere and, you know, crazy greenhouse effect. We've got Mars, which has got an atmosphere. We've got the moon of Titan. So we've come to really understand the laws of planets and climate. So it should be very predictable in some sense of, if you told me what the planet was like, and then you said, oh, they're going to start burning fossil fuels, I would be able to predict for you how long it would take before they started moving their planet into a different climate state. So that should be very generic. And that's why I say that not almost any, because we'd have to do the work to really see what the statistics look like. But for many, many planets that are home to intelligent species, once they start generating a lot of energy, they're going to have this kind of feedback.
I think of you as an optimist, yeah?
Yeah.
This is where I'm not trying to be the pessimist in these conversations, but here's where I get worried. Because as you said on the last program you were on, that we are ending the infancy stage of our civilization, that we get it now. We're not just kids just burning things for the fun of it and
right,
with no consequence.
Yeah.
We understand there are consequences and we're going to have to make choices. And hopefully we make better choices or more informed choices. And that heads off at least some of the concerns, and that we have this opportunity to do it. Then I read a piece like I did in The New Yorker about the earthquake in the Pacific Northwest that is inevitably coming. Did you see that piece?
Yeah.
That is, if you have not read this piece, whatever you're doing tonight, just download it, read it. It was one of the most, I thought, remarkable pieces of journalism, but frightening pieces I have ever read, because as much as we talk about the big one in terms of earthquakes, everyone thinks of California. Right. California will get a big one eventually. The Pacific Northwest will get a bigger one, to the kind that could devastate Seattle and Portland and a lot of that community. And to the point where scientists are now saying, if we knew now, well, let's put it this way. If we were resettling, if we're settling fresh with this knowledge, we wouldn't build Seattle and Portland where they are. That is really horrifying.
Yeah.
And yet I don't see a mass, I'm not saying a mass panic. People shouldn't be running for the hills. But there should be an assessment of, do we need to make some big changes? Do we need to move population centers? It's going to be hard, but should we do it? It's more like fingers in our ears. Seattle's awesome. Portland is awesome. What are you talking about?
We're not leaving.
Right, right. Yeah. And we're overdue for it. Every 243 years for the last 10,000 years, they've had an earthquake that would devastate those communities. And the last one was 311 years ago.
Yeah.
We're overdue.
Yeah, and it's the kind of earthquake that'll turn the ground into liquid, basically. That it'll, you know, go on for 10 minutes of shaking so much that nothing will be left standing.
And one of the biggest tsunamis ever to hit Japan in the year 1700 was 600 miles long. It was that earthquake that sent the tsunami that way. They now know that.
Yeah.
So, and we're not doing anything.
Yeah.
We know it. I'm not saying Seattle and Portland should close.
Right.
But I'm saying we move very slowly because we like the status quo.
I know.
We like gas stations and we like Seattle and Portland right where they are, and we don't like realizing that our choices have consequences.
Yeah. So you ask me, how can I still be optimistic in the face of that? Well, first of all, I'm also cosmically optimistic. I mean, it is absolutely possible that we won't make it, but, you know, I also think that this is kind of a test. And if we don't make it, then we don't deserve to make it, right? I mean, that, you know, this is happening lots of places. Lots of species are coming up to this point, and they either mature or they don't mature. You know, now, obviously, I'm heavily invested because I love my children, you know, and I love humanity, that I hope we make it. But, when I step back and put my astronomers hat on, I'm also like, well, you know, you're going to get what you're going to get. You make the wrong decision, then you pay the price, you know. But for humanity, I do believe I am optimistic about humanity because, you know, there's going to be suffering. There's going to be, you know, there will be more Katrinas. There's going to be more Hurricane Sandys. But unlike the earthquake, like the earthquake that will eventually hit Seattle, and I need to get my kids out of there before because they both live there now.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I'm sorry for bringing this up.
I've talked with them about it, you know. You know, that there's nothing, in some sense, you can move out, but that's going to happen, and then you have to wait another 300 years. Climate change is something that's just going to escalate and escalate and escalate. There's going to be, you know, there will be more and more droughts. There's going to be more and more. So there, you know, people will get the message, and people are already beginning, you know, the drought in California, people are already beginning to see that, you know, we're just beginning to see the effects of climate change. And human beings can be both horrible, you know, look at ISIS, oh my God. But we also have the capacity for such ingenuity and such altruism that I am optimistic that we will eventually get it. We're going to eventually get it, and we're going to figure out how to make the shift.
Let me get another phone call in. My guest is Adam Frank, an astrophysics professor at the University of Rochester, author of a couple of books, contributor to the New York Times, and the co-founder of the NPR 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. John in Rochester is a very, very nice guy, a somewhat regular caller, and he's not going to buy what you're saying on climate change, Adam. I just want to warn you. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Adam.
Hi, John.
Adam, I'm one of the skeptics out there on man-made global warming and climate change. I'm not a scientist, but when you look at our region 12,000 years ago, we were under a mild high glacier, which melted over a period of time without man-made climate change. And I believe the sun is the real cause of climate change.
John, can I ask you a question? John, hold on a second. John,
causes climate change, in my opinion. And man-made climate change, in my opinion, is negligible.
John, can I ask you a question? Do you use antibiotics?
Do I use them?
Yeah, like if your doctor prescribed antibiotics, what would you do?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't use them.
Have you had a surgical procedure any time in the, you know, or do you take medicine?
No, I don't.
You take no medicine at all?
No, I do.
Do you fly in airplanes?
What's that?
Do you fly in airplanes?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, so you know, you're already enmeshed. It's by, you know, do you use a computer?
Yes.
Okay, so there are all these places that you're telling me you don't believe in climate change and that you think that. Wait, let me finish. You don't believe in man-made climate change.
I do believe in climate change.
Okay, you don't believe in man-made climate change.
I don't believe man has a lot of control over it.
Okay, but but what I'm saying is that there are all these things in your life where you are enmeshed in science. And you take what the scientific culture brings you, and you don't stop and say, that airplane's gonna fall out of the sky. I believe that airplane's gonna fall out of the sky. I'm not getting in it. You know, you take the fact that there's a method for testing airplanes, and you get in without questioning. Why is it that just climate change you've decided that the scientists are lying to you? Because Let me finish, John.
John, hold on. I'm putting you back on hold. I'll bring you back in. Go ahead, Adam.
Okay, so the thing is that the consensus on climate change is now decades old. It is overwhelming. There are maybe like 3 or 4 scientists that you can point to who still would challenge it. Scientists, when I mean like actual climate scientists, as opposed to the thousands and thousands who work on this field. So what I just don't understand with people is how they sort of arbitrarily decide, I'm going to not believe that whole part of science, but I'm going to use all the other things about science.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I think it's dogma. There's a lot of dogma involved. There was a University of East Anglia out of Britain going back, I think, maybe 6-7 years ago, where they falsified data in the North Atlantic Ocean.
That's absolutely not true. It's been shown multiple times. That's not true. This is just, I mean, no.
A dogmatic culture, which it's really... flat earthers, in my opinion.
Well, that's good that that's your opinion, but, you know, it sounds like you're not actually involved in the research. You don't do the research. We've put so much human effort into trying to understand this for decades. Hundreds of thousands of human hours put into this, and you're arbitrarily deciding you don't want to believe that. Why do you believe in climate change, but you believe that the Earth goes around the sun?
I've done a book on the lack of substance behind man-made global warming. He's a meteorologist on the West Coast.
So what about NASA? Do you believe NASA? Is NASA lying to you?
Well, I believe...
No. Just answer that question. Is NASA, which just got that probe to Pluto, is NASA lying to you? Because NASA says climate change is happening. So either you're telling me that NASA is lying to all of us, or you're arbitrarily deciding to believe what you want to believe.
You're part of a dogmatic movement, and I really think you got caught up in it. You really have. I think...
John, let the host ask you one question. I've asked you it before. What would it take to change your mind on this, John?
Well, Adam hasn't. Let's put it that way.
That's not the question.
I keep an open mind. I just think the evidence is overwhelming that the sun has so much impact on the Earth, which it has for many, many years, and... the glacier meltdown that happened without man-made climate change. I've read articles, I've read books, I've heard meteorologists and other scientists who dispute Adam's findings.
All right, John, we're done with this call. I will say we got to stop pointing to meteorologists who are, let me give you some examples. I know a lot of meteorologists. I've worked with them. They do tremendous work day-to-day, 5-day to 5-day, 10-day to 10-day. I trust Rochester's meteorologists as much as I've seen anybody in the field. They're not climatologists. They're not paleoclimatologists, and that's okay. That's just not what they do. I don't want to hear a citation of another meteorologist on this issue, and that's not denigrating meteorologists. They're great at what they do. They just don't do paleoclimatology. On the question of the rise and the falls, John, you're right. We've seen rises and falls before, just never to the acceleration that we're currently seeing. That's it. Am I wrong, Adam?
Absolutely. And the thing is, because we understand the previous climate is why we understand the climate now. It's like, it's not a mystery to us why there are climate cycles, right? And it's because of all that knowledge we've gained, all those people studying it, that we understand what's happening now.
And I would suggest to John, who I've never met in person, but he's called the program, and he's a really nice guy, and I like him. But my concern is when I ask you, what would it take to change your mind, and you can't tell me there's anything... then the conversation ends. Because let me ask, John, I'm going to ask Adam the same question. Adam, what would it take to change your mind that man is impacting climate change?
Well, I'd have to see. You know, I watch. I actually, because especially I comment publicly on science, I want to really make sure that what I'm saying about climate is correct. So, you know, oftentimes I've called people out on making claims about, like, you know, scientists will say, oh, that storm was absolutely part of climate change. I'll be like, well, no, you really, the data doesn't support, you can't make that claim right now. It may have been, but we're not, we don't have that kind of certainty. You know, what it would take was more data. It would take, I'd have to see over time a growing body of research that pointed away from the fact that the fossil fuels that we're dumping into the atmosphere are altering the radiative properties of the atmosphere and changing. And it's completely possible that could happen, right? I mean, I'm open to data. I'm open, but that's just not the way it's gone. And what I'm, John, I'm sorry to get angry with you, but you have to understand how much this counts now. We've been, you know, we've been playing this game now for decades. And because the media, you know, some in the media have purposely sort of sown discontent where there is none, or sown, but this is what really frustrates me. I've been watching the science since 1986 when I got a job as an undergraduate at NASA. And the climate case has only gotten stronger. And yet somehow in the media, it seems like there's this debate. John, among scientists, there's no debate. The debate ended in like 1996. They've, climate scientists have moved on to other questions. You know, it's like asking people to keep solving 3+3 over and over again. Problem's done. We understand climate change is happening. The more important question now is, how is it going to change?
And as you say, I think that you very poignantly put it, this is an important moment right now. This is the end of the infancy, as you've said.
Right. And we can't afford to play these games anymore where it's he said, she said. And so I do get very, about this, I get strident. Because what this is about, what you're really asking, you're not asking whether climate change is happening. You're asking, what is the scientific debate look like? And that part is absolute. The scientific debate has moved on from whether climate change is happening or not. We have resolved that issue.
Or whether we are impacting
it. Well, right. Whether human beings are driving the Earth's climate into a new state. That part is, you know, is as good as it gets when it comes to science and when it comes to certainty. The big open questions are, where is it going? What's it going to look like? And what kind of changes can we make now?
Okay. I didn't intend to make the last 20 minutes about this. It happens.
It happens.
It has. And I appreciate it. But what else is on the list? We've been talking about the agony of ignorance in science with Adam Frank, who is a scientist and is well attuned to these questions. He wrote a piece for NPR's Cosmos and Culture blog called Science and the Agony of Ignorance. That essentially says, you know, we look at mysteries of the universe, and there are many that do have answers, and we probably will never get them. So your big one is, number one, is there intelligent life? The work you're doing, which will be published when, Mr. Frank?
Well, no, we have to submit it, so we're working on it still.
But do you have a timeline?
I'm hoping we're going to submit sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, so that's... Yeah. And
we'll see. And then it's got to go through the review process. And people may say your idea totally stinks. So this goes back to John's thing. It's like science gets peer reviewed, right?
Right.
And so people could say, you know, Adam, great idea, but actually here's all the mistakes. We're not publishing it. You know?
Yeah. So
that's quality control. In
but
science.
That's the work you're doing. So far, the work leads you to believe, yes, intelligent civilizations do exist in a high number. And the big mystery for you is, what's the average? How long do they last? And do we have a shot to be a long-lasting one of those? What else is on the list of mysteries that probably won't get solved but could in your lifetime?
Let me see. So I have a list. I brought a list here. Well, one is how planets form. There's, you know, we understand certain parts about planet formation, but there are, you know, so this is like a very specific question, right? And this is something I do research on. You know, specifically, how do planets form? What are the mechanisms? Here's another one. Why didn't the dinosaurs become intelligent? Right? The dinosaurs, they were around a long time. Why didn't they sort of evolve intelligence? What's at the center of a black hole? Why does time only move in one direction? Right? Why does time only move forward but not backward? And that's a question I do think there's actually, you know, a deeper understanding of physics would teach us something about that. What does quantum mechanics mean? Right? Quantum mechanics, which is the theory of the very small. We've had it for 100 years. Every piece of digital technology we have depends on it. But when the question of what it's telling us about the nature of matter, we still don't know. We still don't really understand.
I watched Lost for 6 years waiting for an answer on that. Never got it, by the way.
Right. What happened before the Big Bang? That's a good question. That's a question that should have some kind of answer. How many chucks could a woodchuck chuck? Assuming a woodchuck could chuck wood. Why do fools fall in love? You know, these are all the... How does memory work? Right? Where is, like, you know, if I ask you to think about your grandmother,
Where's it coming from?
Yeah, where's it coming from? There's, like, not a cell that's the grandmother cell. Is artificial intelligence possible? You know, will we ever be able to, like, develop a machine that actually wakes up and is self-conscious? So, Here, that's a partial list.
The addendum to that, and our listeners have heard me say this before, is if we could build an AI machine that wakes up and is self-conscious, should we?
That's an interesting question.
That's a very,
right? Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Are we just sort of basically eliminating ourselves right after the moment
this
after
may be
that
the
happens?
Great filter.
That's right.
This may be the moment where we're staring down why it's always about 200 years because the technological civilizations think, this will be great. I'll be able to order anything. Amazon knows what I want to order. And then the next thing you know.
Yeah, the machine's like, no. You have to decide how you're going to worship me, right? That's a famous science fiction story.
And I know it's sort of ridiculous, but I do think there are legitimate concerns about that.
I agree with you completely. I think this goes to the question of science and politics that, you know, we don't really, and this goes back to the climate change issue, right? One of the reasons John has this attitude is because we've gotten this crazy thing about our inability to deal with science and the domain of politics. And artificial intelligence is another place. This is coming down the road, potentially. Who decides whether we should keep doing research on this or not?
Oof.
Yeah.
Last one, since Pluto's been in the news, I've got about 45 seconds. What's the most exciting thing we learned, and what's the biggest mystery that came out of it?
Well, the most exciting thing we learned was just seeing how alive the planet is. When I mean alive, you know, in quotes, that there's ice flows on them. There was so much more structure on the planet than we thought. You know, than I would have expected. I thought it was going to be kind of just like a dead ice ball. But it seems like as far away as it is, the sunlight is still able to warm things up enough to get, you know, ice melting and or flowing. And then there was this haze. They had this, you know, this chemical haze surrounding the whole planet. And nobody thought that was going to be there. So that there is this outgassing of material from Pluto was kind of a surprise.
So you'd like, if you could answer one question that came from that, it would be?
I'm actually more interested in general of why is there so many, you know, Pluto's got like 5 moons. How did this end up as being such a complicated system?
Well, maybe we'll get an answer, but that one probably not. That took a long time to get New Horizons there.
Yeah. And it'll be a while before we go back.
And I've said this, I have visited rest stops in this country, and I think, how do human beings even civilize and exist? And then we can send a probe to Pluto, and it's amazing what we can do. And Adam Frank is the optimist and brings us back to these great questions that have answers, and maybe you're the kind of person who will help us find them. Thanks for coming in. I love these conversations.
It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
Let's come back sometime with Adam Frank, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio on Connections.